This is February 3rd, 2013, and the title of this talk is Getting Beyond Thoughts. Going to be coming at this a lot of different ways. There's no end of things that we can think about thoughts and say about them. And so hopefully I don't have so much material that this becomes a disjointed mess, but if it does, svaha. So this whole issue of truth being beyond thoughts, this is the foundation of the Zen school. And there's a sort of slogan attributed to Bodhidharma back in the mists of early time. Zen is a separate transmission outside the sutras, independent of words or writing, pointing directly to the human mind and enabling one to perceive one's true nature and attain Buddhahood. A lot of different translations of the Chinese, but that's the gist of it. And at the time, that was a radical departure. There are accounts of Bodhidharma being spat upon because he didn't show proper respect to the sutras, to the written word. It's really almost a postmodern thought that thought cannot encompass truth. It's a very Buddhist thought. It also goes back, if you read what the Buddha said, it's right in accord with that. Describing the Zen practice, Bodhidharma is reported to have said, "Outwardly, all activities cease. Inwardly, the mind stops its panting. When one's mind has become a wall, then he may enter the Tao." Of course, every day, or almost every day, when we chant affirming faith in mind, most of us are familiar with the line, "To see great mind with thinking mind is certainly a grave mistake." But this is a Dharma talk, so I'm going to be using words and letters and throwing out thoughts. But that's what Zen is like. The problem, the reason this for me seems like such an excellent topic is because it's so common for people to work very hard at Zen practice and still stay trapped in thoughts, still stay on the surface. Everybody gets caught on the surface from time to time, and for some people they can go months or years and just not get down below the level of mental chatter, or not be able ever to break up certain disruptive and painful thoughts about themselves, or how well they're doing, or what they need to do, or how they look, or all the other stupid things that we attach ourselves to. So, why is it so hard to get beneath the surface? The first obvious reason is just the momentum of habit. Anybody, especially in the modern West, has been thinking from very early childhood. It's how we've used our minds our whole life. And thinking, for most of us, is our go-to tool. It's powerful and it's practical. And we're rewarded for the ability to think on our feet, to think quickly, to size things up, to predict, to organize. Of course, I've said this before, but because it's our default option, we use it in inappropriate places, like when we cross our legs. There's a saying everybody's heard, "To a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail." And a lot of times we don't even know that we're thinking. I do a lot of talks to high school and college students and get them to sit for the first time, and it's always a shock to people to suddenly discover that their mind is buzzing with incessant thought that won't stop. It's actually sort of the first step in practice is to turn around and realize that there is a coursing stream of thought running through the mind nonstop, day and night. Well, not always in the night, because everybody at some point goes into deep sleep, and somehow we're totally sufficient and happy and content, and there's not a thought in the mind. But the minute we wake up, it begins, and in dreams. So we don't even know we're thinking, and we don't notice how our thoughts color and condition our world. Usually people think that the problems, the dissatisfaction they're having in their life is something that's coming from the outside. It's not. It's really, really coming from our thoughts. I'm not going to trot out Anthony DeMello today, but it does occur to me that when the bell really rang for him and really realized that things are mentally conditioned, was when he met a man in India who had terminal cancer, impoverished, homeless, and the man was completely happy. Any situation that we're in where we're miserable because of conditions, it's good sometimes to just stop and remember someone else in exactly the same condition wouldn't have a problem. Somebody who's not caught up in wanting things to be different. This effort of Zazen, it's because even though you may be finding yourself caught in thoughts, unable to disentangle yourself, it doesn't mean you're not working hard. But often for people, effort just means doing the same thing over and over again, even when it doesn't work. Time to time, you have to ask yourself, what do I need to do? How am I closed off? There's a saying in AA, don't try harder, try different. Need to mix it up. Need to be experimental. We need to be curious. If your goal is just to be an acceptable Zen student, avoid criticism, then you're going to settle for just doing the same thing again and again. But if your goal is to realize your freedom, if you have faith that inherently you are free, living in truth, then you're going to find a way. So I'm going to take a look at this from three different points of view, I hope. I want to read from a Japanese Zen teacher named Uchiyama. So we'll take a Zen look at it. And I want to look at it from a really interesting article on neuroscience, studying what goes on in the brain at the moment of insight. And I want to look at it from the point of view of psychotherapy. So we'll see how far we get. So Uchiyama, this is a Kosho Uchiyama. I don't believe he's not alive today, but he was a 20th century Japanese Zen teacher. A lot of Westerners studied with him. And he wrote several books recently in the TI. Truman was mentioning his commentaries on Dogen's Instructions to the Cook, and mentioned how much he enjoyed that. And maybe that's why I thought of Uchiyama, or maybe it's just because the title is Opening the Hand of Thought, and that's what I'm talking about. But here's where he sort of lays it out. And let me just read from this. He says, I have said that if you sit and think during Zazen, then that is thinking and not doing Zazen. Does that mean no thoughts at all should occur to us during Zazen? Is Zazen that condition when all thoughts have ceased to come into our minds? Here we have to clearly distinguish chasing after thoughts and thinking from ideas or thoughts merely occurring. If a thought occurs during Zazen and we proceed to chase after it, then we are thinking and not doing Zazen. Yet this doesn't mean that we are only doing Zazen when thoughts have entirely ceased to occur. How should we understand this contradiction? It says, imagine placing a large rock next to a person doing Zazen. Since this rock is not alive, no matter how long it sits there, a thought will never occur to it. Unlike the rock, however, the person doing Zazen next to it is a living human being. Even if we sit as stationary as the rock, we cannot say that no thoughts will occur. On the contrary, if they did not, we would have to say that person is no longer alive. As Roshi has said, the brain, we can think of the brain as an organ that secretes thoughts. They're always coming into the mind. It says, of course, the truth of life never means to become lifeless like the rock. For that reason, thoughts ceasing to occur is not the ideal state of one sitting Zazen. It's perfectly natural that thoughts occur. Yet, if we chase after thoughts, we are thinking and no longer doing Zazen. So what should our attitude be? Then he gives his definition. Briefly, our attitude in Zazen is aiming at maintaining the posture of Zazen with our flesh and bones and with our mind letting go of thoughts. What is letting go of thoughts? Well, when we think of something. Thinking of something means grasping that something with thought. However, during Zazen, we open the hand of thought that is trying to grasp something and simply refrain from grasping. This is letting go of thoughts. As Bodhidharma said, inwardly the mind stops its panting. It's difficult to do because we're conditioned to grasp thoughts. That's what we do. That's what we've been doing. But this is the whole key to Zazen, is just that one little move, letting go our grasp. And because you were conditioned to think, we will grasp our thoughts. Nobody's going to do this perfectly, certainly not in the beginning. And this is not a problem. It isn't a problem to make a mistake. Because in each moment, we can let go. That's really it. Just catching ourselves, letting go. Coming back to the posture, coming back to the practice, as the Chinese say, to the method, whether that's the breath or koan. For Uchiyama, it's shikantaza, so that's why he always says, maintaining the posture of Zazen with our flesh and bones. There's really nothing else to hang on to. And then he paints a picture. I really like this. It's hard to convey it because it's actually, he has a diagram here in the book. If anybody's interested, they might take a look at it. But he says, for example, if a thought A, a flower, occurs, as long as it's not followed by thought B, is beautiful, no such meaning as AB, or a flower is beautiful, is formed. So even if thought A does occur, as long as the thought doesn't continue, A occurs prior to the formation of a meaningful sequence. It is not measurable in terms of meaning, and it will disappear as consciousness flows on. Maybe this is a little complicated, but basically our problem is linking one thought to another. Roshi's used the metaphor of driving down a highway, a superhighway with exits periodically. And when we latch on to a thought, it's as if we take an exit. We take the exit. We're curving off away from the road. And that we can go pretty far astray. You can wander through city streets, and you can find yourself eventually in a trailer down by the river. But the problem with this metaphor is that when you realize that you're thinking, when you let go the hand of thought, you immediately return to this very moment of Zazen. You're back in the present. You're back in reality. Back on the highway. Such a simple maneuver. I like also what Roshi said about attention as a flashlight. We can flick that beam anywhere we want. It's almost effortless. And we can be in the middle of any number of thick, sticky, painful, or bewitching thoughts, and in one moment of awareness, come right back. And in fact, that coming back is the engine of progress, if we can talk about progress. It's the engine of change in Zazen. It's getting a taste for coming back to the present, coming back to the practice. People often spend a lot of time obsessing about how well they're doing or how poorly they're doing. And I sort of shrink a little bit even from talking about, you know, being stuck on the surface, because it's sort of an invitation for people to assess their practice and think, am I on the surface or am I getting deep? Or no, I'm on the surface, I suck. And, you know, it's not our job to hold ourselves to some standard of excellence. Our job is way, way more in the moment than that. We're not in the business of evaluation. We're in the business of returning. That's all it is. Thought A links to thought B, links to thought C. We catch it, and we're back. Here's what Uchiyama says. The Zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors, the Zazen of the reality of life, is not like this. And by this he means limited Zazen of self-control, pushing away thoughts. Since desires and cravings are actually a manifestation of the life force, there is no reason to hate them and try to extinguish them. And yet, if we become dragged around by them and chase after them, then our life becomes fogged over. It's a really good image. It's like a screen comes down, everything goes gray when we're caught up in thoughts. And when we're not, when they clear, when suddenly we're just awake in the moment, everything sparkles. Everything's bright and alive. It's like we've just gotten off the plane in Florida and we're driving across the causeway. It is not a matter of making a great effort not to be dragged around by desires. It is just waking up and returning to the reality of life that is essential. If we apply this to Zazen, it means that even if various thoughts like A and B do occur, they will all vanish when we wake up to Zazen. we keep getting duped because we confuse thinking with reality. We confuse the thought for the thing. We confuse thinking about doing Zazen with actually doing Zazen. But you can't be thinking, you can't be pursuing thoughts and come to any kind of awakening. You can't have insight when you're caught on the surface. I wanna read a little bit of an article called The Eureka Hunt. It's given to me by a friend. It appeared in the New Yorker back in 2008, July 28th, 2008. It's written by Jonah Lehrer. It's one of the articles called From the Annals of Science, The Eureka Hunt, Why Do Good Ideas Come to Us When They Do? And it's really about the neuroscience of insight. And I think it's really helpful in sort of cementing our understanding of why it is we need to get beyond thought. It's really back when Uchiyama was first writing, back when Zen was first being introduced to the West, it seemed like that was sort of a lone voice, probably not the case, but a lone voice in talking about this reality beyond thought. And pointing out the paradoxical nature of thought, that we can't think about the thing and realize it at the same time. But now, 50 years later, 70 years later, science is there, psychotherapy is there. It's we know, it's confirmed that there is a reality beyond thought, and it can be accessed through direct experience. The reality is direct experience. So he leads off this article with a little story about a pretty famous instance of insight, and I'll just summarize it quickly because it's from a book that I read with fascination many years ago. The book was called Young Men and Fire. It was written by a guy who I think his name was Norman MacLean. He also wrote the book A River Runs Through It, which became a movie with Robert Redford. So you know he's legit. And it's about this one incident. It was a fire that happened in Montana in 1949, and a crew of firefighters, smoke eaters as they were called, was dropped into this gully where the fire was burning. And the leader of the man in charge was named Wag Dodge, a great name. So they all jumped out of a C-47, and it looked like a pretty manageable fire. They landed on the opposite side of the gully and started working their way down. And then conditions changed, and the wind shifted direction, and the fire jumped from one side of the gully to the other, and all of a sudden they were looking at a wall of fire a quarter mile away, 50 feet high, 300 feet deep, and moving at about 700 feet a minute towards them. Says Dodge screamed at his men to retreat. They dropped their gear and started running up the steep canyon wall, trying to reach the top of the ridge where they would be safe. So he looked over his shoulder and he saw there's no way. Fire's coming way too fast. And at that moment, when he saw that, he had an insight and he stopped running. He lit a match, started burning the grass in front of him, and then when it had burned, he jumped into it, lay down, put a wet handkerchief to his mouth, and let the fire go past him. And because he was laying in a burnt-out area, he lived. He survived, completely intact. 13 smoke jumpers died in the Man Gulch fire, and white crosses below the ridge still mark the spots where the men died. but after several terrifying minutes, Dodge emerged from the ashes virtually unscathed. What he doesn't mention here is I think that one or two of the other firefighters joined Dodge. I can't remember if any did or not. A few others survived. Maybe they managed to outrun the fire because they were farther up. But he tried, as people went running by him, to get them to come into this little burnt area that he had made. But people were putting all their effort into this doomed effort to outrun the fire. He writes, "There's something inherently mysterious about moments of insight. Wag Dodge, for instance, could never explain where his idea for the escape fire came from. It just seemed the logical thing to do was all he could muster. His improbable survival has become one of those legendary stories of insight, like Archimedes shouting 'Eureka!' when he saw his bathwater rise, or Isaac Newton watching an apple fall from a tree and then formulating his theory of gravity. Such tales all share a few essential features which psychologists and neuroscientists use to define, quote, the insight experience, end quote. The first of these is the impasse. Before there can be a breakthrough, there has to be a mental block. This really is reminiscent, of course, of koan work. Until we come to an impasse, we can't have that insight. As long as we're on the level of figuring things out, we're never going to have it. Quite a long article. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. He talks about this guy, Jung Beeman, who's been studying the nature of insight, and he really got interested when he heard a talk by a psychologist named Jonathan Schuller, who had demonstrated that it was possible to interfere with insight by making people explain their thought processes while trying to solve a puzzle, a phenomenon he called verbal overshadowing. This made sense to Jung Beeman. His interest was really in understanding the differences between the left and right hemispheres of the brain and the value of the right hemisphere. He worked with a lot of patients who had right hemisphere damage, and they were always told by their doctors, you're really lucky because this hemisphere does a lot less than the left and nothing to do with language. But he would find that patients with right hemisphere damage really had trouble understanding the nuances of conversation, that there was something that they were missing, even though they had all their logical faculties intact. So it made sense to him that the act of verbal explanation would naturally shift activity to the left hemisphere, causing people to ignore the more subtle associations coming from the right side of the brain. He says, that's when I realized that insight could be a really interesting way to look at all these skills the right hemisphere excelled at. I guess I had an insight about insight." So the first problem he had was finding some way to examine this, and most people know this is sort of a new glorious age in neuroscience in terms of watching what's going on in the brain. We have functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, and we have EEG, the electroencephalograph, basically wiring up the brain and seeing the electrical, what's going on electrically there. Unfortunately, in order to study insight, an MRI, the fMRI, is too slow. It has about, what that measures is the flow of blood to various areas of the brain. You can sort of see the process shift from area to area and make some conclusions from that. But fMRI has a 3 to 5 second delay as the blood diffuses across the cortex. He said insights happen too fast for fMRI. But he was able to combine it with EEG, and there was all kinds of jury rigging that needed to be done with that, wiring up many different areas of the brain, and I won't go into all the technical details. So they had all the wiring so they could look at what was going on, and then they devised a series of puzzles that would call forth the moment of insight. By this insight, I don't mean suddenly realizing the truth of the universe. I'll give you an example of a word puzzle that they used. The subject is given three words such as pine, crab, and sauce, and asked to think of a word that can be combined with all three. All right, who's got the word? Pine, crab, sauce. Subjects have about up to 30 seconds to solve the puzzle, and if they come up with an answer, they hit the space bar and say whether the answer arrived via insight or analysis. The answer, by the way, is apple. Pineapple, crabapple, applesauce. So these problems are called compound remote associate problems, or CRAP. Says the joke is beginning to get old, and in his scientific papers, Jung Beeman decorously leaves off the final P, so they're called CRA word puzzles. So what they find with people working on these puzzles, if they arrive at the answer via insight, of course the answer just suddenly jumps into their mind, and everybody's had that experience, even though nobody did with pine, crab, and sauce. He says, although the answer seemed to appear out of nowhere, the mind was carefully preparing itself for the breakthrough. And then he talks about various areas of the brain that light up, but at the same time, various sensory areas like the visual cortex go silent as the brain suppresses possible distractions. The cortex does this for the same reason we sometimes close our eyes when we're trying to think. Focus is all about blocking stuff out. Next comes the search phase. And it can get quickly frustrating. It takes only a few seconds before people say that they've reached an impasse, that they can't think of the right word. And at that point is when it's up to the brain to switch over to this other way of problem solving, basically to move the process over into the right hemisphere. So sometimes just when the brain is about to give up, an insight appears. You can see people bolt up in their chair and their eyes go all wide. Sometimes they even say, aha, before they blurt out the answer. The suddenness of the insight comes with a burst of brain activity. 300 milliseconds before a participant communicates the answer, the EEG registers a spike of gamma rhythm, which is the highest electrical frequency generated by the brain. Gamma rhythm is thought to come from the binding of neurons, as cells distributed across the cortex draw themselves together into a new network, which is then able to enter consciousness. It's as if the insight had gone incandescent. Basically, what they find about the process is it's a delicate mental balancing act. The brain lavishes the scarce resource source of attention on a single problem. But once the brain is sufficiently focused, the cortex needs to relax in order to seek out the more remote association in the right hemisphere, which will provide the insight. The relaxation phase is crucial. That's why so many insights happen during warm showers. There's the example of the scientist who discovered the benzene ring. I think it came to him as he was stepping onto a bus. And of course, Zen is full of stories of people who came to awakening at a sudden sound or having finally, I know one story that used to always sort of motivate me and scare me at the same time was someone who came to awakening just as he was about to throw himself to his death in frustration over his inability to come to awakening. You always wonder how many people actually did throw themselves. He was one of the lucky ones. There are many stories of people who didn't quite go to that extreme. But there is, you know, it's quite clear that there needs to be this relaxation. And it's interesting, you know, the people who went to China recently on the pilgrimage that happened, I don't know, a couple years ago, came back, and I heard from several of them that the Chinese talked a lot about relaxing. We can easily get into that sort of greedy, clenched state where we're trying to push distraction away and concentrate so hard that somehow we're going to make this breakthrough that's sitting there in the back of our mind that we occasionally think about. And that is a way that doesn't really work. At some point, we have to allow something else to take over. We have to surrender. Really, that kind of relaxation is surrender. As Roshi says, we have to trust the process. It's just fascinating to me that, you know, they can hook people up and see so much of this that has been understood for hundreds and thousands of years in Zen and in other forms of Buddhism and other forms of meditation. Interesting thing, he says, he's found he can tell which subjects will solve insight puzzles up to 8 seconds before the insight actually arrives. See a steady alpha wave rhythm happening in the right brain. Clenched state of mind may inhibit the sort of creative connections that will lead to sudden breakthroughs. This guy Schooler, who first got him going on this, the one who talked about verbal overshadowing, I think it was called, recently demonstrated that making people focus on the details of a visual scene as opposed to the big picture can significantly disrupt the insight process. It doesn't take much to shift the brain into left hemisphere mode. Just takes a moment of thought, and then there's a separation as great as between heaven and earth. It's reminded me of when I'm trying to remember something, and my wife will usually helpfully start to throw out ideas. You know, well, did it have to do with this? Did it have to do with that? Did it have to do with this? And we've gone through this a million times, and I tell her, I can't think of it if you make suggestions. And really, it's this exact process. We're trying to let the brain relax and let the answer come up out of an area that we don't normally have access to. But if we keep the logical approach, it's sort of like looking underneath the streetlight for the keys we lost over in the bushes. You know, it's logical, it's clear, we know what we're doing, and we're never going to get an answer. So I'm going to move on and take a look at this, I guess what we can call the dysfunctionality, if that's a word, of being stuck in thought. And I want to look at something from a form of psychotherapy called ACT therapy, which stands for acceptance and commitment therapy. And there's a concept they use there which is called cognitive fusion. And this is, I'm reading here from a book by Russ Harris, MD, called Act Made Simple, an easy-to-read primer on acceptance and commitment therapy. It says, why the term fusion? Well, think of two sheets of metal fused together. If you couldn't use the term fused, how would you describe them? Welded, melded, bonded, joined, attached, stuck. All these terms point to the same idea, no separation. In a state of cognitive fusion, we're inseparable from our thoughts, we're welded to them, bonded to them, so caught up in them that we aren't even aware that we are thinking. Thus, defusion means separating, detaching, or distancing from our thoughts, taking a step back and seeing them for what they are, nothing more or less than words and pictures. Cognitive fusion basically means that our thoughts dominate our behavior. Thus, in ACT, we may talk with clients of being pushed around by your thoughts, or allowing thoughts to tell you what to do, or we may talk of thoughts as bullies, or we may compare the mind to a fascist dictator, or we may ask, this is a really good question, what happens when you let that thought run your life? Reminds me of one of the four questions that Byron Katie, this really interesting woman who we don't have time to talk about, has, is how does that thought make you feel? Similarly, when our thoughts dominate our attention, we often talk about being hooked, entangled, caught up, or carried off by them. Human beings dwell in two different worlds. At birth, we dwell only in the world of direct experience. You can tell that this form of therapy has been influenced by Zen. The world as we know it directly through the five senses, the world that we can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. But as we grow older, we learn to think, and as that ability grows, we start to spend more and more time in a second world, the world of language. Fusion means we're stuck in the world of language. We're so caught up in all those words and pictures running through our head that we lose contact with the world of direct experience. Mindfulness is like a shuttle between these two worlds. It transports us from the world of language into this world of direct experience. Channeling Roshi, looking through my papers. There we go. I actually did a fake Roshi Teisho for a Sangha entertainment one year. That was a big part of it, was just shuffling papers for 5 or 10 minutes. Where it really gets difficult to let go of thoughts, to basically get out of this state of that they're calling cognitive fusion, is when our thoughts are about us, when they're negative, and when we're under stress. Want to make the point that even though these thoughts are so difficult and we dislike them, they're actually pretty valuable because they do show us where we're stuck and they motivate us to find a different way of living. If there wasn't dukkha, there wouldn't be the motivation to practice. So a good example, of course, is anxiety. Most people dealing with anxiety typically get stuck in trying to push it away, which doesn't work. And most of us have had that experience. End up in just a morass, a swamp, a bog of thoughts, all of them painful, recycling over and over again, often unable to sleep. And the problem is that we're trying so hard to get out. We're not doing what Uchiyama says, to simply let the thoughts go, to relax our grasp. Instead, we're fighting with them, or we're trying to hold them at bay. So there's a really, really helpful metaphor that's used in ACT therapy for dealing with anxiety or any other difficult kind of thought pattern, feeling pattern. It says, suppose you come across someone standing in the middle of a pool of quicksand. There are no ropes or tree branches available. The only way you can help them is by talking to them. The person shouts, "Help! Get me out!" and is beginning to do what people do, struggling to get out. And 99.9% of the time, the effective action to take is to walk, run, step, hop, or jump out of trouble, but not with quicksand. Normally, to step out of something, you need to lift one foot and move the other forward. With quicksand, that's a bad idea. Once one foot is lifted, all your weight is on the other foot, half the previous surface area, and the downward pressure doubles. The person sinks deeper. As you watch, you see them starting to sink deeper, and if you understand how quicksand works, you might shout at them to lie flat, spread-eagled, to maximize contact with the surface. The person, therefore, probably won't sink and might be able to roll to safety. Since the person is trying to get out of the quicksand, it goes against all their natural instincts to maximize body contact with it. Someone struggling to get out of the mud may never realize that the wise and safer action is to get with the mud. Our own lives can be very much like this. The normal problem-solving methods that we use, sometimes repeatedly for years, to try to deal with the struggles we face, may themselves be part of the problem, just like someone trying to get free of the quicksand. And so we have this concept of accepting negative thoughts, acceptance and commitment therapy. Acceptance is the first part. Here it's put in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different arenas. Being okay with things as they are. It's one of the linchpins of Alcoholics Anonymous. Accepting not only circumstances, but mental states. But the one caveat about that is that acceptance doesn't actually work as a technique. And let me read this to sort of explain what I mean. This is more ACT business. It's from an article by Michelle Ayers and Carol Vivian, written in 2010 and adapted from this fellow Stephen Hayes, who's one of the primary, if not the primary, guys in ACT. And also, to give him credit, was the person who had the quicksand analogy that I just read from. So this is their little piece about accepting anxiety. We all hate being anxious. It's a horrible feeling. It feels overwhelmingly disturbing, and understandably, we try to keep it at bay by avoiding anything that might make us anxious, or by doing things that help us feel safer in those situations where we feel anxious. These, of course, are strategies that end up limiting our lives and making us avoid doing the things that we really value, because all our effort is going into avoiding our anxiety or trying to minimize it. Then they say, if you're not willing to have it, you will. Look at this sentence. What does it mean? If I'm not willing to be anxious, I will be anxious. What does that mean? Our mind might say, so if I'm not willing to be anxious, I will be anxious. I hate being anxious. So I guess I could give it a try. I'll try to be more willing to feel my anxiety so I won't be anxious. Okay. But if you decide you could be willing to be anxious in order to get rid of the anxiety, then you're not really willing to be anxious. and that will result in feeling more anxious. They say, this is not mumbo jumbo. Read it again. It's brilliant. It sounds weird, not right, yet it seems that it's true. If you're only willing to feel anxiety because you hope that by being willing to feel it, it will reduce your anxiety, then it cannot work. That is not the same as being willing to feel your anxiety. This has so many ramifications, and it applies. I don't want to sit here and draw every single parallel and connection, but it applies so directly to our zazen. The moment we're caught up in technique, the moment our looking directly or letting thoughts go or bringing our curiosity to bear, the minute that is for the sake of creating a result, it's poisoned. The state of mind that we're looking for is a total reliance on the present moment, which means a total abandonment of concern with results. It's the genius of Uchiyama's formulation, maintaining the zazen posture with our flesh and bones. There's no agenda. They go on to say, anxiety is normal. We all feel it. We will all continue to feel it at times. To help start practicing willingness to accept anxiety, one, notice when you start to feel the normal body response to unhelpful thoughts. Two, don't struggle or fight with the feelings or thoughts. Let them be. Three, it will pass. Just notice. This is just a normal body response to unhelpful thoughts, and it will pass. Just speaking for myself, there's a shift that happens when you realize, oh, this is actually kind of cool. I get a chance to see this and feel this. You know, you can talk and I can talk about anxiety or talk about anger, but until it comes up, you can't really learn anything direct about it. We're just dealing with thoughts. So actually having the negative experience is a golden opportunity. Going back to our friend Byron Katie, it's a compassionate alarm clock letting us know we're caught in the dream. To be able to see that as a welcome guest can change everything. And I'm going to read here a poem from Rumi, and then I'm truly out of time. He says this being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. We invite them in, and we let them leave, neither grasping nor pushing away. Well, there's more that could be said, but that's as good a stopping point as any, and I've used up all our time, so we'll go right to the four vows.